Welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Maitland. Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you, but the information on this podcast should not be considered legal advice. The views expressed on the show did not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or Queen's Faculty of Law. In the midst of a global pandemic, Canada also faces an epidemic that's killing thousands of Canadians every year: opioid overdoses. Between 2016 and 2020, over 17,000 Canadians have died, and so many young people have died that the epidemic has actually lowered the life expectancy of Canadians. The amount of overdose deaths in the country are rising, in part due to COVID-19. Interruptions in the drug trade have led to a more tainted drug supply. Canadian healthcare systems are overworked, and any support is increasingly difficult to access. Between April and June of 2020, there were 58% more deaths than in the first quarter of the year. Many of these overdoses are caused by fentanyl, an opioid that's used alone or cut into other opioids like heroin. Fentanyl is up to 10 times stronger than morphine. It's used often in medical procedures when a dose is carefully calculated by a medical professional. In recreational use, the strength of fentanyl creates a high risk of overdose for those who haven't used it before or don't know that they're consuming it. Provinces have implemented programs like supervised consumption sites, which provide people with access to drug testing, clean equipment, and medical care in the case of overdose. They've also distributed free naloxone kits at pharmacies. Naloxone can temporarily reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. But neither of these policies have been able to fully address this crisis. This has led to growing calls for the federal government to decriminalize the use of drugs. Advocates for the policy say that decriminalizing possession would help to end the stigma around drug use, encourage those facing addiction to seek treatment, and prevent deaths by overdose that are rapidly rising across Canada. One of those advocates is Liberal Member of Parliament Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who recently tabled two private members' bills that would shift the government's approach to drug use from a matter of crime to one of public health. Nathaniel is the MP for Beaches East York in Toronto and is a member of Queen's Law's class of 2010. Since being elected in 2015, he's garnered a reputation of political independence, encouraging respectful dissent within Parliament and openly disagreeing with his party on controversial issues like gun control and drug policy. Before politics, he practiced commercial litigation in Toronto and received his Bachelor of Civil Law from the University of Oxford. Nate joins me today to discuss his work and why this conversation is more important now than ever. Thanks, Nate, for joining me today. I'd like to start by giving our listeners a bit of insight on what exactly decriminalization means. There's a lot of confusion and sometimes conflation in the media and in politics between legalizing drugs and decriminalizing drugs. And the Conservative Party has run ads before claiming that the current government intends to legalize and sell drugs. So can you explain the difference between those two concepts and why you are in favor of decriminalization?
It's a good question because there is a lot of confusion, and it's probably also worth differentiating between different kinds of legalization. So obviously alcohol is legal and morphine is legal, and all of these things are regulated in very different ways, and some are very tightly controlled. Decriminalization simply says, as it relates to simple possession, so it doesn't touch trafficking, it doesn't touch producing, whereas a legal framework would bring to bear regulations and rules as it relates to production and distribution. Decriminalization simply focuses on the people who use substances or possess substances for personal use and says, we aren't going to criminalize those people anymore. We're not going to threaten them with criminal sanctions. And it's possible. We see in Portugal, as an example, we see a different kind of intervention. So it's not a world free of intervention. So where someone is caught possessing a substance for personal use that is a controlled substance, that there is an intervention where someone goes before a dissuasion commission of a social worker, a health professional, and a legal professional. But you could also imagine a situation where we don't have an intervention at all, and we just provide education and, you know, sufficient health resources where people are ready to seek treatment. Those treatment options are available.
You often use the term evidence-based drug policy and have used Portugal's drug laws as an example of this. Portugal decriminalized the possession of drugs in 1999, and they saw an 80% decrease in overdose deaths, according to the Drug Policy Alliance.
So tell me more about why you focus on evidence-based drug policy and how that's different from the policies we currently see in Canada.
Very simply, evidence-based drug policy would be to look at what are we doing? What are the rules that we have in place? What are the outcomes that we see because of the rules that we have in place? And are the rules fulfilling the objectives that we have in serving Canadians and in protecting Canadians? And when we look at Portugal as an example, and when I talk about evidence-based drug policy, there is an example where they do something very different. And they've been doing it very differently for over 20 years now. And we can see from that jurisdiction that has decriminalized drugs, we saw the number of people seeking treatment increase by 60%. We saw obviously a decline in incarceration, but we also saw no noticeable increase in drug use. And in fact, problematic drug use for young people actually declined. So we know that the criminal laws that we have in place in Canada that get in the way of the people who need help and the help that they need, that stigmatize the people who stigmatize people who use drugs, we know that they are completely ineffective, that they don't serve the purpose we wanted to serve. And in fact, they're contrary to the very purposes that we want to serve and the people we want to help. The last thing I'll say on evidence, though, is sometimes experimentation is required and pilot projects are required. So it's really interesting to see conservatives slowly but surely change some of their rhetoric, because for so long they've been attacking safe consumption sites to the point that, you know, when Harper was our prime minister, he and his government took the safe consumption site in Vancouver, InSight, all the way to the Supreme Court trying to shut it down. And yet the evidence was clear. The Supreme Court said unanimously, its benefits have been proven, it saves lives. And so what does it mean, evidence-based drug policy? It means looking at that experimentation, that evidence, and to say, let's actually expand upon that success. And that's exactly what we've done. We now have pilot projects as it relates to safer supply. As we build up the evidence, we will hopefully expand upon those projects.
Because drug use falls both under federal criminal law and provincial healthcare, constitutional challenges can arise when looking for solutions to this crisis. The City of Vancouver has taken a really interesting approach to addressing this problem by requesting a citywide exemption to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, and Montreal recently voted to do the same. How would that exemption work?
It could work in a number of different ways, and it will depend upon the conversations that take place and the agreement that ultimately is reached between Vancouver and the federal government. In a very simple way, the federal government should get out of the way, and we should say Section 4 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, Section 4 being the penalty for possessing substances for personal use, that simply isn't going to apply in the City of Vancouver. Now, you could imagine a model that is more focused on diversion and that would still have an intervention of some sort. But I think the simplest path and the easiest way of establishing an exemption would be for us to simply get out of the way. Now, I'm not entirely certain what Mayor Stewart is requesting as far as the scope of the exemption. Those conversations, I understand, are active and underway from my last conversation with Minister Haidu, and I'm going to be speaking with actually Kennedy Stewart to figure out on his side how things are going somewhat soon. But I personally think it's pretty straightforward that we just say Section 4 doesn't apply in these boundaries.
Advocates in Toronto have also voiced support for this program, including the chief medical officer of the city, but it hasn't yet been brought forward to the city council. If decriminalization doesn't happen on a federal level, would you like to see this program in your city?
Unquestionably, yes. So I want to see the federal government take action. I think the prime minister should take more serious action. When you see over 16,000 Canadians who have died because of the opioid crisis since January 2016, when you have public health experts and police chiefs, by the way, so in July, the police chiefs have called for decriminalization and following the evidence to save lives. When you have so many people with experience in this space, not to mention people with lived experience or people who have lost loved ones themselves, they are all calling for the very same thing. I think it's incumbent on the federal government principally to act, but where the politics can be challenging, and let's be honest, the politics can be challenging. I've heard from colleagues in my own caucus who say, well, it's going to be really difficult to explain to this constituency or to explain in that part of the country. Well, if we really see that as insurmountable, and I don't believe that it is, But if we take the easy way out on politics at the federal level, then I would love to see it at the municipal level. And I think Vancouver is going to play a really important role here. Montreal will hopefully follow suit. And Toronto should be no different. We have a very progressive politics in Toronto. And I do think that if there was a motion at city council, that we'd have the chief public health officer here. We'd have certainly a number of advocacy organizations. We'd have the police. I mean, there'd be a number of experts and advocacy organizations and individuals who would stand up and say, this is the right thing. And I'm hopeful that the mayor and council would see it through. So I think it's incumbent where the federal government isn't leading on this. And we obviously aren't going to see, I think it's really important that cities with that progressive constituency do stand up and lead the way.
You recently introduced two private members' bills. C-235 would decriminalize the possession of drugs, and C-236 provides diversion measures by requiring police officers to consider measures other than judicial proceedings to deal with charges of possession of drugs, including the option of recommending treatment, and it sets out some principles to be taken into account in making that decision. Can you tell us about those bills and why you introduced two?
So the two bills are related insofar as they are both seeking to address our outdated, ineffective, and harmful drug laws. C-235 is really straightforward. I mentioned Section 4 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. This would simply delete Section 4. So possessing drugs for personal use would no longer be a crime. And if provinces, potentially the federal government, but more likely provinces, wanted to implement some kind of health intervention, they would still, of course, be free to do that. But the federal government and particularly the criminal law would be removed from trying to support people because we know that it is getting in the way and it is only hurting people. Now, I mentioned the politics. So I didn't believe that I was going to get support for C-235 from the government. And I wanted to continue this conversation, not only to have a vote at second reading on a decriminalization bill. I wanted to further this conversation by having experts attend and speak to decriminalization at committee. So I thought through and worked with colleagues, worked with Justice, and tried to find a compromise position. And I think that I found one in C-236, and C-236 does not completely fulfill decriminalization as an outcome. It doesn't delete Section 4, but it establishes a series of call on the federal government to treat drug use health issue as opposed to a criminal issue that recognizes the costs and problems of a heavy hand and that the criminal code is a blunt instrument and ineffective in this area. It's costly, recognizes that we need to actually take a human rights based approach and support individuals and people who use drugs. What it very simply does is it says a peace officer, a police officer, and a prosecutor can't lay a charge or proceed with a charge unless they've already explored other alternatives and those alternatives are insufficient. So just say giving a warning, say referring someone to a healthcare provider. My expectation would be if this bill became law that we would have de facto decriminalization and that police officers and prosecutors would get out of the business of policing and prosecuting simple possession of drugs for personal use.
You briefly mentioned the role that political parties can play in this fight for decriminalization. And although it's not an official policy of your party, it was voted to be one by liberals at a national convention in 2018. Do you see the government and other parties warming up to this idea in the near future? Is it something that can get multi-partisan support?
It's really interesting how quickly these conversations can move. We saw with Insight, I mentioned, and the conservatives being so opposed to safe consumption sites. Well, they've taken a very different tact in recent months and over the last couple of years, where they haven't been so vocally opposed, at least at the federal level. We still see, obviously, Jason Kenney and even Premier Ford be a bit intransigent as it relates to safe consumption sites and evidence-based treatment. But when we look at the federal conservatives, they have not pushed in the same way. They have not pushed back against safe consumption sites in the same way. And I think the answer is because they've looked at it and said the politics isn't what it used to be. And this tough on crime business, when people are dying and the evidence is so clear and we've already been sort of chastised by the Supreme Court, the politics don't help us here. Now, not so different when you look at cannabis, that they were really fomenting fears as it relates to cannabis legalization. They don't do that anymore. And why is that? Because the politics has shifted significantly. And I think too, when you now see the police chiefs on board and calling for decriminalization and evidence-based drug policy, when against the backdrop of thousands of Canadians dying and public health experts who we have listened to, not perfectly, but who we've listened to and have great stature in this pandemic, that we should listen to these same experts. Here's what they're saying as it relates to the opioid crisis. And so I do think the politics have shifted significantly already, not perfectly yet. We see Aaron O'Toole recently in the media say, well, he doesn't believe there should be serious consequences for people who possess drugs for personal use. That's a huge shift for the conservatives, but let's be honest, no penalties should be warranted for people who possess drugs for personal use. So it's not a complete shift to the evidence. In the debate on C-236, when I brought it forward, John Barlow, a conservative from Foothills, Alberta, said, well, you know, I think we're able to support this bill if there are amendments. And he started to emphasize the need for, as opposed to a voluntary referral to treatment, that there should be a mandatory imposition of treatment. And if that's the space where we're going to have a debate, I think the conversation has moved significantly. It's not a perfect conversation yet. Mandatory treatment doesn't work. So there's still education required with conservatives, but I would say it's a marked difference from where we have been. And so I am not optimistic we're going to see decriminalization and evidence-based laws tomorrow, but that we will get there sooner than we think.
Thanks so much, Nate. I think you're doing a great job of pushing this forward, and it's really great to see another, well, a Queen's Law grad doing this work, and I'm excited to see what happens with these bills. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Maitland. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. The views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, producer, or Queen's Faculty of Law, and the information provided in this podcast should not be considered legal advice. For more information about Pro Bono Radio, go to probonoradio.com.